luck. Actually, forget the 10 minutes. The gates open now. Book of Fire. The dark came in pieces, and with the cigarette brought to an end, Liesel and Hans Huberman began to walk home. To get out of the square, they would walk past the bonfire site and through a small side road onto Munich Street. They didn't make it that far. A middle-aged carpenter named Wolfgang Edel called out. He'd built the platforms for the Nazi big shots to stand on during the fire, and he was in the process now of pulling them down.
Hans Huberman!
He had long sideburns that pointed to his mouth, and a dark voice.
Hansi!
Hey, Wolfel,
Hans replied. There was an introduction to the girl, and a
Heil Hitler!
Good, Liesel. For the first few minutes, Liesel stayed within a 5-meter radius of the conversation. Fragments came past her, but she didn't pay too much attention.
Getting much work?
No, it's all tighter now, you know how it is, especially when you're not a member.
You told me you were joining, Hansi.
I tried, but I made a mistake. I think they're still considering.
Liesel wandered toward the mountain of ash. It sat like a magnet, like a freak, irresistible to the eyes, similar to the road of yellow stars. As with her previous urge to see the mound's ignition, she could not look away. All alone, she didn't have the discipline to keep a safe distance. It sucked her toward it, and she began to make her way around. Above her, the sky was completing its routine of darkening, but far away, over the mountain's shoulder, there was a dull trace of light.
"Pass auf, Kind," a uniform said to her at one point. "Look out, child,"
as he shoveled some more ash onto a cart. Closer to the town hall, under a light, some shadows stood and talked, most likely exulting in the success of the fire. From Liesel's position, their voices were only sounds, not words at all. For a few minutes, she watched the men shoveling up the pile, at first making it smaller at the sides to allow more of it to collapse. They came back and forth from a truck, and after 3 return trips, when the heap was reduced near the bottom, a small section of living material slipped from inside the ash.
The material. Half a red flag, 2 posters advertising a Jewish poet, 3 books, and a wooden sign with something written on it in Hebrew.
Perhaps they were damp. Perhaps the fire didn't burn long enough to fully reach the depth where they sat. Whatever the reason, they were huddled among the ashes, shaken. Survivors. 3 books, Liesel spoke softly, and she looked at the backs of the men.
Come on, said one of them. Hurry up, will you? I'm starving.
They moved toward the truck. The threesome of books poked their noses out. Liesel moved in. The heat was still strong enough to warm her when she stood at the foot of the ash heap. When she reached her hand in, she was bitten, but on the second attempt, she made sure she was fast enough. She latched on to the closest of the books. It was hot, but it was also wet, burned only at the edges, but otherwise unhurt. It was blue. The cover felt like it was woven with hundreds of tightly drawn strings and clamped down. Red letters were pressed into those fibers. The only word Liesel had time to read was shoulder. There wasn't enough time for the rest, and there was a problem, the smoke. Smoke lifted from the cover as she juggled it and hurried away. Her head was pulled down, and the sick beauty of nerves proved more ghastly with each stride. There were 14 steps till the voice. It propped itself up behind her.
Hey!
That was when she nearly ran back and tossed the book onto the mound, but she was unable. The only movement at her disposal was the act of turning.
There are some things here that didn't burn!
It was one of the clean-up men. He was not facing the girl, but rather the people standing by the town hall.
Well, burn them again, came the reply, and watch them burn. I think they're wet.
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, do I have to do everything myself?
The sound of footsteps passed by. It was the mayor, wearing a black coat over his Nazi uniform. He didn't notice the girl, who stood absolutely still, only a short distance away. A realization. A statue of the book thief stood in the courtyard. It's very rare, don't you think, for a statue to appear before its subject has become famous? She sank. The thrill of being ignored. The book felt cool enough now to slip inside her uniform. At first, it was nice and warm against her chest. As she began walking, though, it began to heat up again. By the time she made it back to Papa and Wolfgang Edel, the book was starting to burn her. It seemed to be igniting. Both men looked at her. She smiled. Immediately, when the smile shrank from her lips, she could feel something else. Or more to the point, someone else. There was no mistaking the watched feeling. It was all over her, and it was confirmed when she dared to face the shadows over at the town hall. To the side of the collection of silhouettes, another one stood, a few meters removed, and Liesel realized two things. A few small pieces of recognition. One, the shadow's identity, and two, the fact that it had seen everything. The shadow's hands were in its coat pockets. It had fluffy hair. If it had a face, the expression on it would have been one of injury. "God verdammt," Liesel said, only loud enough for herself. "God damn it." "Are we ready to go?" In the previous moments of stupendous danger, Papa had said goodbye to Wolfgang Edel and was ready to accompany Liesel home. "Ready," she answered. They began to leave the scene of the crime, and the book was well and truly burning her now. The shoulder shrug had applied itself to her ribcage. As they walked past the precarious town hall shadows, the book thief winced. "What's wrong?" Papa asked. "Nothing." Quite a few things, however, were most definitely wrong. Smoke was rising out of Liesel's collar. A necklace of sweat had formed around her throat. Beneath her shirt, a book was eating her up. Part 3. Mein Kampf. Featuring The Way Home, A Broken Woman, A Struggler, A Juggler, The Attributes of Summer, An Aryan Shopkeeper, A Snorer, Two Tricksters, and Revenge in the Shape of Mixed Candy. The Way Home. Mein Kampf. The book penned by the Führer himself. It was the third book of great importance to reach Liesel Memminger. Only this time, she did not steal it. The book showed up at 33 Himmel Street, perhaps an hour after Liesel had drifted back to sleep from her obligatory nightmare. Some would say it was a miracle that she ever owned that book at all. Its journey began on the way home, the night of the fire. They were nearly halfway back to Himmel Street when Liesel could no longer take it. She bent over and removed the smoking book, allowing it to hop sheepishly from hand to hand. When it had cooled sufficiently, they both watched it a moment, waiting for the words. "Papa, what the hell do you call that?" He reached over and grabbed hold of the shoulder shrug. No explanation was required. It was obvious that the girl had stolen it from the fire. The book was hot and wet, blue and red, embarrassed, and Hans Hubermann opened it up. Pages 38 and 39. "Another one?" Liesel rubbed her ribs. "Yes, another one." "Looks like," Papa suggested, "I don't need to trade any more cigarettes, do I? Not when you're stealing these things as fast as I can buy them." Liesel, by comparison, did not speak. Perhaps it was her first realization that criminality spoke best for itself. Irrefutable. Papa studied the title, probably wondering exactly what kind of threat this book posed to the hearts and minds of the German people. He handed it back. Something happened. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. Each word fell away at its edges. It broke off and formed the next. The criminal could no longer resist.
What, Papa? What is it?
Of course. Like most humans in the grip of revelation, Hans Hubermann stood with a certain numbness. The next words would either be shouted or would not make it past his teeth. Also, they would most likely be a repetition of the last thing he'd said only moments earlier. Of course. This time, his voice was like a fist freshly banged on the table. The man was seeing something. He was watching it quickly, end to end, like a race, but it was too high and too far away for Liesl to see. She begged him,
"Come on, Papa, what is it?"
She fretted that he would tell Mama about the book. As humans do, this was all about her.
"Are you going to tell?"
"Sorry?"
"You know, are you going to tell Mama?"
Hans Hubermann still watched, tall and distant. "About what?" She raised the book.
"This!"
She brandished it in the air as if waving a gun. Papa was bewildered.
"Why would I?"
She hated questions like that. They forced her to admit an ugly truth, to reveal her own filthy, thieving nature.
"Because I stole again?"
Papa bent himself to a crouching position, then rose and placed his hand on her head. He stroked her hair with his rough, long fingers and said,
"Of course not, Liesl. You are safe."
"So what are you going to do?"
That was the question. What marvelous act was Hans Hubermann about to produce from the thin Munich street air? Before I show you, I think we should first take a look at what he was seeing prior to his decision. Papa's fast-paced visions. First, he sees the girl's books, the Gravedigger's Handbook, Faust the Dog, the Lighthouse, and now the Shoulder Shrug. Next is a kitchen and a volatile Hans Jr., regarding those books on the table where the girl often reads. He speaks, "And what trash is this girl reading?" His son repeats the question 3 times, after which he makes his suggestion for more appropriate reading material. "Listen, Liesl." Papa placed his arm around her and walked her on. "This is our secret, this book. We'll read it at night or in the basement, just like the others. But you have to promise me something."
"Anything, Papa."
The night was smooth and still. Everything listened. "If I ever ask you to keep a secret for me, you will do it."
"I promise."
"Good. Now come on, if we're any later, Mama will kill us, and we don't want that, do we?"
"No more book stealing then, huh?" Liesl grinned. What she didn't know until later was that within the next few days, her foster father managed to trade some cigarettes for another book, although this one was not for her. He knocked on the door of the Nazi Party office in Mulking and took the opportunity to ask about his membership application. Once this was discussed, he proceeded to give them his last scraps of money and 12 cigarettes. In return, he received a used copy of Mein Kampf.
"Happy reading," said one of the party members.
"Thank you," Hans nodded. From the street, he could still hear the men inside. One of the voices was particularly clear.
"He will never be approved," it said, "even if he buys 100 copies of Mein Kampf."
The statement was unanimously agreed upon. Hans held the book in his right hand, thinking about postage money, a cigaretteless existence, and the foster daughter who had given him this brilliant idea.
"Thank you," he repeated, to which a passerby inquired as to what he'd said. With typical affability, Hans replied, "Nothing, my good man, nothing at all. Heil Hitler!"
And he walked down Munich Street, holding the pages of the Führer. There must have been a good share of mixed feelings at that moment, for Hans Hubermann's idea had not only sprung from Liesl, but from his son. Did he already fear he'd never see him again? On the other hand, He was also enjoying the ecstasy of an idea, not daring just yet to envision its complications, dangers, and vicious absurdities. For now, the idea was enough. It was indestructible. Transforming it into reality, well, that was something else altogether. For now, though, let's let him enjoy it. We'll give him 7 months. Then we come for him. And oh, how we come. The Mayor's Library. Certainly something of great magnitude was coming toward 33 Himmel Street, to which Liesel was currently oblivious. To distort an overused human expression, the girl had more immediate fish to fry. She had stolen a book. Someone had seen her. The book thief reacted appropriately. Every minute, every hour, there was worry, or more to the point, paranoia. Criminal activity will do that to a person, especially a child. They envision a prolific assortment of caught-outedness. Some examples: people jumping out of alleys, schoolteachers suddenly being aware of every sin you've ever committed, police showing up at the door each time a leaf turns or a distant gate slams shut. For Liesel, the paranoia itself became the punishment, as did the dread of delivering some washing to the mayor's house. It was no mistake, as I'm sure you can imagine, that when the time came, Liesel conveniently overlooked the house on Grunderstrasse. She delivered to the arthritic Helena Schmidt and picked up at the cat-loving Weingartner residence, but she ignored the house belonging to Bürgermeister Heinz Hermann and his wife Ilse. Another quick translation. Bürgermeister, Mayor. On the first occasion, she stated that she simply forgot about that place. A poor excuse, if ever I've heard one, as the house straddled the hill, overlooking the town, and it was unforgettable. When she went back and still returned empty-handed, she lied that there was no one home. No one home? Mama was skeptical. Skepticism gave her an itch for the wooden spoon. She waved it at Liesel and said, "Get back over there now, and if you don't come home with the washing, don't come home at all." "Really?" That was Rudy's response when Liesel told him what Mama had said. "Do you want to run away together? We'll starve." "I'm starving anyway." They laughed. "No," she said, "I have to do it." They walked the town as they usually did when Rudy came along. He always tried to be a gentleman and carry the bag, but each time Liesel refused. Only she had the threat of a Watschen loitering over her head, and therefore only she could be relied upon to carry the bag correctly. Anyone else was more likely to manhandle it, twist it, or mistreat it in even the most minimal way, and it was not worth the risk. Also, it was likely that if she allowed Rudy to carry it for her, he would expect a kiss for his services, and that was not an option. Besides, she was accustomed to its burden. She would swap the bag from shoulder to shoulder, relieving each side every 100 steps or so. Liesel walked on the left, Rudy the right. Rudy talked most of the time about the last soccer match on Himmel Street, working in his father's shop, and whatever else came to mind. Liesel tried to listen but failed. What she heard was the dread chiming through her ears, growing louder the closer they stepped toward Grunderstrasse. "What are you doing? Isn't this it?" Liesel nodded that Rudy was right, for she had tried to walk past the mayor's house to buy some time. "Well, go on," the boy hurried her. Malking was darkening, the cold was climbing out of the ground. "Move it, Saumensch!" He remained at the gate. After the path, there were 8 steps up to the main entrance of the house, and the great door was like a monster. Liesel frowned at the brass knocker. "What are you waiting for?" Rudy called out. Liesel turned and faced the street. Was there any way at all for her to evade this? Was there another story, or let's face it, another lie, that she'd overlooked? "We don't have all day," Rudy's distant voice again. "What the hell are you waiting for? Will you shut your trap, Steiner?" It was a shout delivered as a whisper. "What?"
I said shut up, you stupid Zaukel!
With that, she faced the door again, lifted back the brass knuckle, and tapped it 3 times, slowly. Feet approached from the other side. At first, she didn't look at the woman, but focused on the washing bag in her hand. She examined the drawstring as she passed it over. Money was handed out to her, and then nothing. The mayor's wife, who never spoke, simply stood in her bathrobe, her soft, fluffy hair tied back into a short tail. A draught made itself known, something like the imagined breath of a corpse. Still, there were no words, and when Liesl found the courage to face her, the woman wore an expression not of reproach, but utter distance. For a moment, she looked over Liesl's shoulder at the boy, then nodded and stepped back, closing the door. For quite a while, Liesl remained, facing the blanket of upright wood.
"Hey, Zaumensch!"
No response.
"Liesl!"
Liesl reversed, cautiously. She took the first few steps backward, calculating. Perhaps the woman hadn't seen her steal the book after all. It had been getting dark. Perhaps it was one of those times when a person appears to be looking directly at you, when in fact they're contentedly watching something else or simply daydreaming. Whatever the answer, Liesl didn't attempt any further analysis. She'd gotten away with it, and that was enough. She turned and handled the remainder of the steps normally, taking the last 3 all at once.
"Let's go, Zaukel!"
She even allowed herself a laugh. 11-year-old paranoia was powerful. 11-year-old relief was euphoric. A little something to dampen the euphoria. She had gotten away with nothing. The mayor's wife had seen her, all right. She was just waiting for the right moment. A few weeks passed. Soccer on Himmel Street. Reading the shoulder shrug between 2 and 3 o'clock each morning, post-nightmare, or during the afternoon, in the basement. Another benign visit to the mayor's house. All was lovely. Until. When Liesl next visited minus Rudy, the opportunity presented itself. It was a pick-up day. The mayor's wife opened the door, and she was not holding the bag like she normally would. Instead, she stepped aside and motioned with her chalky hand and wrist for the girl to enter.
"I'm just here for the washing."
Liesl's blood had dried inside of her. It crumbled. She almost broke into pieces on the steps. The woman said her first word to her then. She reached out, cold-fingered, and said, "Warte. Wait." When she was sure the girl had steadied, she turned and walked hastily back inside.
"Thank God," Liesl exhaled. "She's getting it."
It being the washing. What the woman returned with, however, was nothing of the sort. When she came and stood with an impossibly frail steadfastness, she was holding a tower of books against her stomach, from her navel to the beginnings of her breasts. She looked so vulnerable in the monstrous doorway. Long, light eyelashes, and just the slightest twinge of expression. A suggestion. "Come and see," it said. "She's going to torture me," Liesl decided. "She's going to take me inside, light the fireplace, and throw me in, books and all. Or she'll lock me in the basement without any food." For some reason, though, most likely the lure of the books, she found herself walking in. The squeaking of her shoes on the wooden floorboards made her cringe, and when she hit a sore spot, inducing the wood to groan, she almost stopped. The mayor's wife was not deterred. She only looked briefly behind and continued on to a chestnut-colored door. Now her face asked a question. "Are you ready?" Liesl craned her neck a little, as if she might see over the door that stood in her way. Clearly that was the cue to open it.
"Jesus Mary," she said it out loud.
The words distributed into a room that was full of cold air and books.
Books.
everywhere. Each wall was armed with overcrowded yet immaculate shelving. It was barely possible to see the paintwork. There were all different styles and sizes of lettering on the spines of the black, the red, the grey, the every-coloured books. It was one of the most beautiful things Liesel Memminger had ever seen. With wonder, she smiled that such a room existed. Even when she tried to wipe the smile away with her forearm, she realized instantly that it was a pointless exercise. She could feel the eyes of the woman traveling her body, and when she looked at her, they had rested on her face. There was more silence than she ever thought possible. It extended like an elastic, dying to break. The girl broke it.
"Can I?"
The two words stood among acres and acres of vacant, wooden-floored land. The books were miles away. The woman nodded. "Yes, you can." Steadily, the room shrank, till the book thief could touch the shelves within a few small steps. She ran the back of her hand along the first shelf, listening to the shuffle of her fingernails gliding across the spinal cord of each book. It sounded like an instrument, or the notes of running feet. She used both hands. She raced them, one shelf against the other, and she laughed. Her voice was sprawled out high in her throat, and when she eventually stopped and stood in the middle of the room, she spent many minutes looking from the shelves to her fingers and back again. How many books had she touched? How many had she felt? She walked over and did it again, this time much slower, with her hand facing forward, allowing the dough of her palm to feel the small hurdle of each book. It felt like magic, like beauty, as bright lines of light shone down from a chandelier. Several times she almost pulled a title from its place, but didn't dare disturb them. They were too perfect. To her left, she saw the woman again, standing by a large desk, still holding the small tower against her torso. She stood with a delighted crookedness. A smile appeared to have paralyzed her lips.
"Do you want me to?"
Liesel didn't finish the question, but actually performed what she was going to ask, walking over and taking the books gently from the woman's arms. She then placed them into the missing piece in the shelf by the slightly open window. The outside cold was streaming in. For a moment, she considered closing it, but thought better of it. This was not her house, and the situation was not to be tampered with. Instead, she returned to the lady behind her, whose smile gave the appearance now of a bruise, and whose arms were hanging slenderly at each side. Like girls' arms. What now? An awkwardness treated itself to the room, and Liesel took a final fleeting glance at the walls of books. In her mouth, the words fidgeted, but they came out in a rush. "I should go." It took three attempts to leave. She waited in the hallway for a few minutes, but the woman didn't come, and when Liesel returned to the entrance of the room, she saw her sitting at the desk, staring blankly at one of the books. She chose not to disturb her. In the hallway, she picked up the washing. This time, she avoided the sore spot in the floorboards, walking the long length of the corridor, favoring the left-hand wall. When she closed the door behind her, a brass clank sounded in her ear, and with the washing next to her, she stroked the flesh of the wood. "Get going," she said. At first, she walked home, dazed. The surreal experience with a roomful of books and the stunned, broken woman walked alongside her. She could see it on the buildings, like a play. Perhaps it was similar to the way Papa had his Mein Kampf revelation. Wherever she looked, Liesel saw the mayor's wife with the books piled up in her arms. Around corners she could hear the shuffle of her own hands, disturbing the shelves. She saw the open window, the chandelier of lovely light, and she saw herself leaving, without so much as a word of thanks. Soon, her sedated condition transformed to harassment and self-loathing. She began to rebuke herself.
"You said nothing."
Her head shook vigorously among the hurried footsteps. "Not a goodbye, not a thank you, not a 'that's the most beautiful sight I've ever seen.' Nothing." Certainly she was a book thief, but that didn't mean she should have no manners at all. It didn't mean she couldn't be polite. She walked a good few minutes, struggling with indecision. On Munich Street, it came to an end. Just as she could make out the sign that said Steiner, Schneidermeister, she turned and ran back. This time there was no hesitation. She thumped the door, sending an echo of brass through the wood.
Scheiße!
It was not the mayor's wife, but the mayor himself who stood before her. In her hurry, Liesel had neglected to notice the car that sat out front on the street. Moustached and black-suited, the man spoke.
"Can I help you?"
Liesel could say nothing. Not yet. She was bent over, short of air, and fortunately the woman arrived when she'd at least partially recovered. Ilse Hermann stood behind her husband to the side.
"I forgot," Liesel said. She lifted the bag and addressed the mayor's wife.
Despite the forced labor of breath, she fed the words through the gap in the doorway, between the mayor and the frame, to the woman. Such was her effort to breathe that the words escaped only a few at a time.
"I forgot. I mean, I just wanted," she said, "to thank you."
The mayor's wife bruised herself again. Coming forward to stand beside her husband, she nodded very faintly, waited, and closed the door. It took Liesel a minute or so to leave. She smiled at the steps.
Enter the Struggler. Now for a change of scenery. We've both had it too easy till now, my friend, don't you think? How about we forget mulking for a minute or two? It will do us some good. Also, it's important to the story. We will travel a little to a secret storage room, and we will see what we see. A guided tour of suffering. To your left, perhaps your right, perhaps even straight ahead, you find a small black room. In it sits a Jew. He is scum. He is starving. He is afraid. Please, try not to look away. A few hundred miles northwest, in Stuttgart, far from the book thieves, mayor's wives, and Himmel Street, a man was sitting in the dark. It was the best place, they decided. It's harder to find a Jew in the dark. He sat on his suitcase, waiting. How many days had it been now? He had eaten only the foul taste of his own hungry breath for what felt like weeks, and still nothing. Occasionally voices wandered past, and sometimes he longed for them to knuckle the door, to open it, to drag him out into the unbearable light. For now he could only sit on his suitcase couch, hands under his chin, his elbows burning his thighs. There was sleep, starving sleep, and the irritation of half-awakeness and the punishment of the floor. Ignore the itchy feet, don't scratch the soles, and don't move too much. Just leave everything as it is, at all cost. It might be time to go soon. Light like a gun, explosive to the eyes. It might be time to go. It might be time, so wake up. Wake up now, goddammit. Wake up! The door was opened and shut, and a figure was crouched over him. The hand splashed at the cold waves of his clothes and the grimy currents beneath. A voice came down behind it.
"Max," it whispered. "Max, wake up."
His eyes did not do anything that shock normally describes. No snapping, no slapping, no jolt. Those things happen when you wake from a bad dream, not when you wake into one. No, his eyes dragged themselves open from darkness to dim. It was his body that reacted, shrugging upward and throwing out an arm to grip the air. The voice calmed him now. Sorry it's taken so long. I think people have been watching me, and the man with the identity card took longer than I thought, but... There was a pause. It's yours now. Not great quality, but hopefully good enough to get you there if it comes to that. He crouched down and waved a hand at the suitcase. In his other hand, he held something heavy and flat. Come on. Off. Max obeyed, standing and scratching. He could feel the tightening of his bones. The card is in this. It was a book. You should put the map in here, too, and the directions, and there's a key taped to the inside cover. He clicked open the case as quietly as he could and planted the book like a bomb. I'll be back in a few days. He left a small bag filled with bread, fat, and 3 small carrots. Next to it was a bottle of water. There was no apology. It's the best I could do. Door open. Door shut. Alone again. What came to him immediately then was the sound. Everything was so desperately noisy in the dark when he was alone. Each time he moved, there was the sound of a crease. He felt like a man in a paper suit. The food. Max divided the bread into 3 parts and set 2 aside. The one in his hand he immersed himself in, chewing and gulping, forcing it down the dry corridor of his throat. The fat was cold and hard, scaling its way down, occasionally holding on. Big swallows tore them away and sent them below. Then the carrots. Again he set 2 aside and devoured the 3rd. The noise was astounding. Surely the Führer himself could hear the sound of the orange crush in his mouth. It broke his teeth with every bite. When he drank, he was quite positive that he was swallowing them. Next time, he advised himself, drink first. Later, to his relief, when the echoes left him and he found the courage to check with his fingers, each tooth was still there, intact. He tried for a smile, but it didn't come. He could only imagine a meek attempt and a mouthful of broken teeth. For hours, he felt at them. He opened the suitcase and picked up the book. He could not read the title in the dark, and the gamble of striking a match seemed too great right now. When he spoke, it was the taste of a whisper. "Please," he said. "Please." He was speaking to a man he had never met. As well as a few other important details, he knew the man's name, Hans Hubermann. Again, he spoke to him, to the distant stranger. He pleaded, "Please." The Attributes of Summer. So, there you have it. You're well aware of exactly what was coming to Himmel Street by the end of 1940. I know. You know. Liesel Memminger, however, cannot be put into that category. For the book thief, the summer of that year was simple. It consisted of 4 main elements, or attributes. At times, she would wonder which was the most powerful. And the nominees are... 1. Advancing through the shoulder shrug every night. 2. Reading on the floor of the mayor's library. 3. Playing soccer on Himmel Street. 4. The seizure of a different stealing opportunity. The shoulder shrug, she decided, was excellent. Each night, when she calmed herself from her nightmare, she was soon pleased that she was awake and able to read. "A few pages?" Papa asked her, and Liesel would nod. Sometimes they would complete a chapter the next afternoon, down in the basement. The authorities' problem with the book was obvious. The protagonist was a Jew, and he was presented in a positive light. Unforgivable. He was a rich man who was tired of letting life pass him by, what he referred to as the shrugging of the shoulders to the problems and pleasures of a person's time on earth. In the early part of summer in Malking, as Liesel and Papa made their way through the book, this man was travelling to Amsterdam on business, and the snow was shivering outside. The girl loved that, the shivering snow.
That's exactly what it does when it comes down, she told Hans Hubermann.
They sat together on the bed, Papa half asleep, and the girl wide awake. Sometimes she watched Papa as he slept, knowing both more and less about him than either of them realized. She often heard him and Mama discussing his lack of work, or talking despondently about Hans going to see their son, only to discover that the young man had left his lodging and was most likely already on his way to war.
"Schlaf gut, Papa," the girl said at those times. "Sleep well."
And she slipped around him, out of bed, to turn off the light. The next attribute, as I've mentioned, was the mayor's library. To exemplify that particular situation, we can look to a cool day in late June. Rudy, to put it mildly, was incensed. Who did Liesel Memminger think she was, telling him she had to take the washing and ironing alone today? Wasn't he good enough to walk the streets with her?
"Stop complaining, Saukerl," she reprimanded him. "I just feel bad. You're missing the game."
He looked over his shoulder.
"Well, if you put it like that..." There was a schmunzel. "You can stick your washing."
He ran off and wasted no time joining a team. When Liesel made it to the top of Himmel Street, she looked back just in time to see him standing in front of the nearest makeshift goals. He was waving.
"Saukerl,"
she laughed, and as she held up her hand, she knew completely that he was simultaneously calling her a Saumensch. I think that's as close to love as 11-year-olds can get. She started to run to Grunderstrasse and the mayor's house. Certainly there was sweat and the wrinkled pants of breath stretching out in front of her. But she was reading. The mayor's wife, having let the girl in for the fourth time, was sitting at the desk, simply watching the books. On the second visit, she had given permission for Liesel to pull one out and go through it, which led to another and another, until up to half a dozen books were stuck to her, either clutched beneath her arm or among the pile that was climbing higher in her remaining hand. On this occasion, as Liesel stood in the cool surrounds of the room, her stomach growled, but no reaction was forthcoming from the mute, damaged woman. She was in her bathrobe again, and although she observed the girl several times, it was never for very long. She usually paid more attention to what was next to her, to something missing. The window was opened wide, a square, cool mouth, with occasional gusty surges. Liesel sat on the floor, the books were scattered around her. After 40 minutes, she left. Every title was returned to its place.
"Goodbye, Frau Herrmann."
The words always came as a shock. "Thank you." After which the woman paid her, and she left. Every movement was accounted for, and the book thief ran home. As summer set in, the room full of books became warmer, and with every pickup or delivery day, the floor was not as painful. Liesel would sit with a small pile of books next to her, and she'd read a few paragraphs of each, trying to memorize the words she didn't know to ask Papa when she made it home. Later on, as an adolescent, when Liesel wrote about those books, she no longer remembered the titles. Not one. Perhaps, had she stolen them, she would have been better equipped. What she did remember was that one of the picture books had a name written clumsily on the inside cover. The name of a boy, Johann Herrmann. Liesel bit down on her lip, but she could not resist it for long. From the floor, she turned and looked up at the bathrobed woman and made an inquiry.
"Johann Herrmann," she said. "Who is that?"
The woman looked beside her, somewhere next to the girl's knees. Liesel apologized.
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't be asking such things."
She let the sentence die its own death. The woman's face did not alter, yet somehow she managed to speak.
"He is nothing now in this world," she explained. "He was my..."
The files of recollection. Oh, yes, I definitely remember him. The sky was murky and deep like quicksand.
There was a young man parceled up in barbed wire like a giant crown of thorns. I untangled him and carried him out. High above the earth, we sank together to our knees. It was just another day. 1918.
Apart from everything else, she said, he froze to death.
For a moment she played with her hands, and she said it again.
He froze to death. I'm sure of it.
The mayor's wife was just one of a worldwide brigade. You have seen her before, I'm certain, in your stories, your poems, the screens you like to watch. They're everywhere, so why not here? Why not on a shapely hill in a small German town? It's as good a place to suffer as any. The point is, Ilse Hermann had decided to make her suffering her triumph. When it refused to let go of her, she succumbed to it. She embraced it. She could have shot herself, scratched herself, or indulged in other forms of self-mutilation, but she chose what she probably felt was the weakest option. To at least endure the discomfort of the weather. For all Liesel knew, she prayed for summer days that were cold and wet. For the most part, she lived in the right place. When Liesel left that day, she said something with great uneasiness. In translation, two giant words were struggled with, carried on her shoulder, and dropped as a bungling pair at Ilse Hermann's feet. They fell off sideways as the girl veered with them and could no longer sustain their weight. Together they sat on the floor, large and loud and clumsy. Two giant words.
I'm sorry.
Again, the mayor's wife watched the space next to her. A blank page face.
For what?
She asked, but time had elapsed by then. The girl was already well out of the room. She was nearly at the front door. When she heard it, Liesel stopped, but she chose not to go back, preferring to make her way noiselessly from the house and down the steps. She took in the view of Malking before disappearing down into it, and she pitied the mayor's wife for quite a while. At times, Liesel wondered if she should simply leave the woman alone, but Ilse Hermann was too interesting, and the pull of the books was too strong. Once, words had rendered Liesel useless, but now, when she sat on the floor, with the mayor's wife at her husband's desk, she felt an innate sense of power. It happened every time she deciphered a new word or pieced together a sentence. She was a girl in Nazi Germany. How fitting that she was discovering the power of words. And how awful and yet exhilarating it would feel many months later, when she would unleash the power of this newfound discovery the very moment the mayor's wife let her down. How quickly the pity would leave her, and how quickly it would spill over into something else completely. Now, though, in the summer of 1940, she could not see what lay ahead in more ways than one. She was witness only to a sorrowful woman with a roomful of books whom she enjoyed visiting. That was all. It was part two of her existence that summer. Part three, thank God, was a little more light-hearted. Himmel Street Soccer. Allow me to play you a picture. Feet scuffing road, the rush of boyish breath. Shouted words, here, this way, Scheiße! The coarse bounce of ball on road. All were present on Himmel Street, as well as the sound of apologies, as summer further intensified. The apologies belonged to Liesel Memminger. They were directed at Tommy Müller. By the start of July, she finally managed to convince him that she wasn't going to kill him. Since the beating she'd handed him the previous November, Tommy was still frightened to be around her. In the soccer meetings on Himmel Street, he kept well clear.
You never know when she might snap, he'd confided in Rudy, half twitching, half speaking.
In Liesel's defense, she never gave up on trying to put him at ease. It disappointed her that she'd successfully made peace with Ludwig Schmeichel and not with the innocent Tommy Müller. He still cowered slightly whenever he saw her.
How could I know you were smiling for me that day? She asked him repeatedly.
She'd even put in a few stints as goalie for him, until everyone else on the team begged him to go back in.
"Get back in there," a boy named Harold Mollenhauer finally ordered him. "You're useless."
This was after Tommy tripped him up as he was about to score. He would have awarded himself a penalty, but for the fact that they were on the same side. Liesl came back out and would somehow always end up opposing Rudy. They would tackle and trip each other, call each other names. Rudy would commentate.
"She can't get around him this time, the stupid Zaumensch Arschgrobler. She hasn't got a hope."
He seemed to enjoy calling Liesl an ass-scratcher. It was one of the joys of childhood. Another of the joys, of course, was stealing. Part 4, Summer 1940. In fairness, there were many things that brought Rudy and Liesl together, but it was the stealing that cemented their friendship completely. It was brought about by one opportunity, and it was driven by one inescapable force, Rudy's hunger. The boy was permanently dying for something to eat. On top of the rationing situation, his father's business wasn't doing so well of late. The threat of Jewish competition was taken away, but so were the Jewish customers. The Steiners were scratching things together to get by. Like many other people on the Himmelstreet side of town, they needed to trade. Liesl would have given him some food from her place, but there wasn't an abundance of it there either. Mama usually made pea soup. On Sunday nights she cooked it, and not just enough for one or two repeat performances. She made enough pea soup to last until the following Saturday. Then on Sunday she'd cook another one. Pea soup, bread, sometimes a small portion of potatoes or meat. You ate it up, and you didn't ask for more, and you didn't complain. At first they did things to try to forget about it. Rudy wouldn't be hungry if they played soccer on the street, or if they took bikes from his brother and sister and rode to Alex Steiner's shop, or visited Liesl's papa, if he was working that particular day. Hans Hubermann would sit with them and tell jokes in the last light of afternoon. With the arrival of a few hot days, another distraction was learning to swim in the Amper River. The water was still a little too cold, but they went anyway.
"Come on," Rudy coaxed her in. "Just here. It isn't so deep here."
She couldn't see the giant hole she was walking into, and sank straight to the bottom. Dog paddling saved her life, despite nearly choking on the swollen intake of water.
"You Saukerl,"
she accused him when she collapsed onto the riverbank. Rudy made certain to keep well away. He'd seen what she did to Ludwig Schmeichel.
"You can swim now, can't you?"
Which didn't particularly cheer her up as she marched away. Her hair was pasted to the side of her face, and snot was flowing from her nose. He called after her,
"Does this mean I don't get a kiss for teaching you? Saukerl?"
The nerve of him. It was inevitable. The depressing pea soup and Rudy's hunger finally drove them to thievery. It inspired their attachment to an older group of kids who stole from the farmers, fruit stealers. After a game of soccer, both Liesl and Rudy learned the benefits of keeping their eyes open. Sitting on Rudy's front step, they noticed Fritz Hammer, one of their older counterparts, eating an apple. It was of the Klar variety, ripening in July and August, and it looked magnificent in his hand. Three or four more of them clearly bulged in his jacket pockets. They wandered closer.
"Where did you get those?" Rudy asked.
The boy only grinned at first. "Shh!" And he stopped. He then proceeded to pull an apple from his pocket and toss it over. "Just look at it," he warned them. "Don't eat it." The next time they saw the same boy wearing the same jacket, on a day that was too warm for it, they followed him. He led them toward the upstream section of the Amper River. It was close to where Liesl sometimes read with her papa when she was first learning. A group of five boys, some lanky, a few short and lean, stood waiting. There were a few such groups in Malking at the time, some with members as young as six. The leader of this particular outfit was an agreeable 15-year-old criminal named Arthur Berg. He looked around and saw the two 11-year-olds dangling off the back.
"Und?" he asked. "And?"
"I'm starving," Rudy replied. "And he's fast," said Liesel.
Berg looked at her. "I don't recall asking for your opinion."
He was teenage tall and had a long neck. Pimples were gathered in peer groups on his face.
"But I like you."
He was friendly in a smart-mouthed adolescent way.
"Isn't this the one who beat up your brother, Andel?"
Word had certainly made its way around. A good hiding transcends the divides of age.
Another boy, one of the short, lean ones, with shaggy blonde hair and ice-colored skin, looked over.
"I think so,"
Rudy confirmed.
"It is."
Andy Schmeichel walked across and studied her up and down, his face pensive, before breaking into a gaping smile.
"Great work, kid."
He even slapped her among the bones of her back, catching a sharp piece of shoulder blade.
"I'd get whipped for it if I did it myself."
Arthur had moved on to Rudy. "And you're the Jesse Owens one, aren't you?" Rudy nodded.
"Clearly," said Arthur, "you're an idiot. But you're our kind of idiot. Come on."
They were in. When they reached the farm, Liesel and Rudy were thrown a sack. Arthur Berg gripped his own burlap bag. He ran a hand through his mild strands of hair.
"Either of you ever stolen before?"
"Of course," Rudy certified. "All the time." He was not very convincing. Liesel was more specific. "I've stolen 2 books. At which Arthur laughed in 3 short snorts. His pimples shifted position.
"You can't eat books, sweetheart."
From there, they all examined the apple trees who stood in long, twisted rows. Arthur Berg gave the orders.
"One," he said, "don't get caught on the fence. You get caught on the fence, you get left behind. Understood?"
Everyone nodded or said yes.
"2, one in the tree, 1 below. Someone has to collect."
He rubbed his hands together. He was enjoying this.
"3, if you see someone coming, you call out loud enough to wake the dead, and we all run. Richtig?
Richtig." It was a chorus. 2 debutante apple thieves whispering.
"Liesel, are you sure? Do you still want to do this?"
"Look at the barbed wire, Rudy. It's so high."
"No, no, look, you throw the sack on. See? Like them."
"All right.
Come on, then."
"I can't."
Hesitation.
"Rudy, I—" "Move it, Saumensch."
He pushed her toward the fence, threw the empty sack on the wire, and they climbed over, running toward the others. Rudy made his way up the closest tree and started flinging down the apples. Liesel stood below, putting them into the sack. By the time it was full, there was another problem.
"How do we get back over the fence?"
The answer came when they noticed Arthur Berg climbing as close to a fence post as possible. "The wire's stronger there," Rudy pointed. He threw the sack over, made Liesel go first, then landed beside her on the other side among the fruit that spilled from the bag. Next to them, the long legs of Arthur Berg stood watching in amusement.
"Not bad," landed the voice from above. "Not bad at all."
When they made it back to the river, hidden among the trees, he took the sack and gave Liesel and Rudy 12 apples between them.
"Good work," was his final comment on the matter.
That afternoon, before they returned home, Liesel and Rudy consumed 6 apples apiece within 30 minutes. At first, they entertained thoughts of sharing the fruit at their respective homes, but there was considerable danger in that. They didn't particularly relish the opportunity of explaining just where the fruit had come from. Liesel even thought that perhaps she could get away with only telling Papa, but she didn't want him thinking that he had a compulsive criminal on his hands. So she ate. On the riverbank where she learned to swim, each apple was disposed of. Unaccustomed to such luxury, they knew it was likely they'd be sick. They ate anyway.
"Saumensch," Mama abused her that night. "Why are you vomiting so much?"
"Maybe it's the pea soup," Liesel suggested.
"That's right," Papa echoed. He was over at the window again.
"It must be.
I feel a bit sick myself.
Who asked you, Zaukel?
Quickly she turned back to face the vomiting Zaumensch.
Well, what is it? What is it, you filthy pig?